This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
It's great to be on a campus with a lot of folks who've been looking at the immigration issue and, more than anything, grappling with that, I think, as the country is. Let me tell you a little bit about how I got into this work, although when I say it like that, it almost sounds like it was planned. And I know as students, oftentimes you're asked, you know, what is your five-year plan? What are you going to do? Et cetera, et cetera. I was never one of those folks. I never had a five-year plan or anything like that. So in a way, what I'm doing right now, it's been, you may say, either a happy progression of accidents or fate, right? Who knows? But I came to this country when I was 15 years old, and I was an undocumented immigrant. My family and I came to Los Angeles, and my first job was in the Garmin District in Los Angeles. And I remember my mom was a seamstress, so she was also working in the Garmin District. And they had found two jobs my aunts had. I had a couple of aunts that were already living in L.A. And so they figured they would give me the easy job because I didn't know how to saw. So they gave me a job that required ironing. And then my mom took the sewing job, but we were in different places. And, you know, the one thing I've never forgotten about that job is that I bite my nails, and that was the only time in my life that my nails grew, because I used to get home at the end of the day and pass out. And it just kind of gave me an appreciation, which sometimes as a young person you don't get until you're older, of what your parents go through, right? And then the interesting thing was that after going to high school, I had an opportunity to go to college, and in many ways, had a couple of classmates we really didn't know about each other until probably almost when we were seniors, who were undocumented as well. The interesting thing about the debate today is you constantly find in your life how things come full circle, and then the circle starts over again. And so, in a way, the way this connects is that, you know, we were dreamers before there was a term for it, and before there was really an outward group that you could identify with or belong to. And at the end of the day, I do feel that the real essence of the immigration debate is about much more than immigration, but it really is about belonging in one way or another, both from the folks that are afraid of immigrants as well as for the immigrants that are trying to integrate into U.S. society. So number of different jobs, ended up at NCLR. I've been there for probably almost as some of you might be old, but I've been there for 16 years now. I've had an opportunity to work on a variety of things. And NCLR is a Latino civil rights organization. And the interesting thing is that we are mostly known in the mainstream as an organization that works on immigration, even though it's a very small part of the work we do. But the reason that's telling to me is because immigration is both a public policy issue, and it is also a civil rights issue. Very much a civil rights issue for Latinos and many other ethnic communities. And I'll get into that a little bit. But before I do, I also wanted to acknowledge my husband, who's actually here somewhere, because maybe if you have questions when we get to the Q&A, he actually is the Director of Communications for Congressman Gutierrez, who I used to say, even before my husband worked for him, that it's definitely one of the true champions on the immigration issue. But anyway, so immigration as a policy issue, the last time that Congress really had a dogged legislative fight to pass comprehensive immigration reform was in 2007. And at that point, that fight had been going on for years. So in many ways, the policy conversation about what are the different elements that we need to look at and what are the different things that we need to solve have been looked at and looked at and looked at and looked at. And I think that part of what was happening at the time is that many of us working on trying to get some legislation through Congress were really focused on the merits of the policy of that reform. And the nativist groups that were dominating a lot of the airwaves were really could not care less about the merits of the policy, because in reality for them, as long as immigration remains unresolved, it's a wound that continues to fester, to feed frustrations and anxiety in our country, not just over immigration, but over a variety of other things. And so while those guys were out there trying to paint, the evil of immigration and to paint immigrants as evil, again, we were working with Congress to try to get this done. As the anti-immigrant and anti-Latino environment continued to grow. So in terms of policy, and I know you've heard a little bit about this earlier, for us, really, it's quite simple. And perhaps the biggest irony about this debate is that poll after poll has shown over the years and continues to show today that where the public is concerned, there is actually a broad consensus about what are the different elements of a solution to resolve this. Where we keep getting stuck is with politicians who are putting politics above the solution. Not unique to immigration, right? But definitely something that has been quite frustrating. And again, in terms of policy for us, there's, to oversimplify, there are three components. You need to restore the rule of law, you need to maintain or preserve the rule of law, and you need to advance immigrant integration. And what do we mean by restore the rule of law? I think a lot of folks who oppose comprehensive immigration reform have tried to own that banner, but the reality, and try to define it as being all about enforcement and punitive measures. But the reality is that you cannot restore the rule of law by ignoring the fact that there are about 11 million people living in our country who are contributing to our communities and our economy and have really become deeply intertwined part of our society. I think it's about 3/4 of that 11 million who have been in our country for over 10 years and actually live in families. So you cannot restore the rule of law if you say, we got to seal the border and we got to do a fence and then ignore that there are those folks living in our communities who frankly are vulnerable to wage and working standard violations that ultimately end up affecting and undermining the standards for other working Americans as well. We're all intertwined. In terms of preserving the rule of law, what that means for us is that the reason why we are in this situation, a situation that has fueled the flows of migration through illegal channels, is because, as you were saying, we've been living in a wink and a nod environment where our economy keeps beckoning workers. The system that is supposed to allow employers or jobs and workers meet legally is not working, but those workers in those jobs find each other nevertheless. Everybody kind of looks the other way, and no one is guilty of that, but the reality is that we're all complicit in that. And so in order to preserve the rule of law, we really need to tackle our current system of legal immigration, both on the family side, which is one of the bedrocks of our immigration system, the paths that allow people to reunite with family, whether it is their spouse, their children, or their extended family, and who in many ways, that formula is the formula that has really helped create the integration that continues to happen today as it happened before in our country. Because then you're able to come into and create and be supported by that family unit. So family is part of preserving the rule of law and channels that allow those families to come together and families to stay together, as it is the future flows as they are known. You know, what measures are we going to take to make sure that our immigration system is able to respond to the needs of our economy, but at the same time do so in a way where it's not used to pit one worker against another. So it's not used to manipulate or to suppress the conditions for U.S. workers, and do it in a way that allows that. And in terms of advancing immigrant integration, that's another thing that is quite interesting. Obviously, we see now as before that immigrants continue to integrate into our country. Latinos are the current face of the immigrant wave, certainly not the only ones that are part of that wave, but the most visible face. But their path of integration and becoming part of our country is not any different than it used to be 100 years ago for other immigrants, whether it was the Irish, German, Italian, and other folks who, frankly, by the third generation, and whether you think this is a good idea or not, right, what folks say is the U.S. is sort of a language graveyard. By the third generation, regardless of where you came from, you speak English, and chances are you don't speak whatever language your parents or grandparents spoke. So broadly speaking, those are the three components. And again, they've been argued to death and tweaked to death, and we haven't been able to get there. But at the same time that immigration is a policy issue and, frankly, a fact-free zone, a lot of the coverage in the media tends to be very polarized. And so if you think about where the majority of the public is, even though there is support for what generally we have come to call comprehensive immigration reform, at the same time, it is not the most highly mobilizing issue. So when the battle begins between the very shrill voices that are leading the anti-immigrant debate and those advocating for reform, what somebody in the middle of that would see is just like, blah, 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 right? And like, you don't know where to go, or a lot of times you don't know how to intervene in that. As a policy issue beyond immigration, the issue has also become a Trojan horse of sorts. And what do I mean by that? If you look at the progression of the issue and how it's been used, it has been wielded as the boogeyman to throw a wrench into the progression of a debate on a number of issues, whether we're talking about affordable housing, healthcare. Anybody remember that State of the Union where a member of Congress shouted liar to the president on healthcare on the issue of immigration? It has been used as a boogeyman to suppress voting rights for American citizens. And as often happens when you let fear and anxiety take hold, sometimes you are willing to look the other way while highly pernicious things happen because, you know, you might be able to excuse them by saying, well, that's not going to affect me. That's them, and them should not be here, which is part of the environment around the hate crimes and Lucero's death. So what we saw, for example, also in Arizona, which has been a cradle for a lot of, in a laboratory in many ways for a lot of this legislation, is that Arizona, years before the SB 1070 racial profiling law, passed legislation saying that in order to register to vote, you needed to prove, not have an ID to vote, you needed to prove that you were a citizen. Now, the irony about that is that the people who really have a document straight up that proves that they are a citizen are naturalized immigrants, right? Because you get that certificate. The average American is either going to have to go dig for a birth certificate. How many have a birth certificate within your possession, like now? Any hands? One, two, three. Well, not on you right now, but at least like at your dorm or at your house or anything like that. So we have about five people in this group, right? Again, naturalized immigrants are the most likely to be able to provide that proof, which means that for everybody else, you'll have to figure something else out, except that these laws get presented in such a way that they tend to benefit certain folks over others. And also create an environment where certain folks are going to be questioned more than others whether they have or don't have proof. So again, it was used in Arizona to do that, which had a big effect on the efforts by third-party organizations, nonprofits, and other types of groups to register people, because if you're the average person, do you want to turn over a copy of your certificate to somebody that you don't know? Or are you going to have it with you, right? So there was a whole battle over that, but it kind of started creating that environment where a lot of things were being tested and kind of covered with a veneer of, you know, we got to solve the immigration problem as the lubricant to get them through. In California, there were also debates about increasing the number of documentation that somebody had to present in order to be able to access safety net benefits, even though, as you probably know, undocumented immigrants are already ineligible for the vast, vast majority of any of those. So what is the effect? The effect is that an eligible American or legal resident or legal permanent resident or immigrant now has to show all this documentation. And as everybody knows, an effect of increasing the number of documentation and putting obstacles on enrollment to any of these programs is that less eligible people actually enroll. So there's all that on the policy world that it's percolating, and that a lot of times folks who don't look at the immigration issue become agnostic to until you are like in the midst of it and right in front of it, and you can't push through with progress on an issue because this has gotten thrown in as a roadblock and nobody wants to touch it or nobody wants to stand up and call bull, right? And that is on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. But immigration is also something with an even deeper essence and an even more basic issue right now. Because at its core, this whole conversation really is about who is worthy of being an American. And who is deemed by looking to be an American as well. And so that is why, as a civil rights organization, this issue has become so prominent. And because for Latinos, even though the majority of us, 74% of Latinos in this country are United States citizens. And of Latinos under 18, that number is 93%. But what has happened? With, you know, some people would say as a result, I would almost would say that as an intent of the toxicity in the immigration debate, Latinos have largely become labeled as outsiders. So when you, in a conversation, talk to folks about the fact that 3/4 of Latinos are United States citizens, even if you're talking to a reporter who covers these issues, their jaws drop, because that's how much the perception has been affected. And as a matter of fact, in recent polling, the views of the general public about the percentage of Latinos who are not just immigrant but undocumented is hugely skewed. They believe about 50% are undocumented, not just immigrant but undocumented, read, not belonging here. And so what that does is that, particularly at a time when the Latino community, for lack of a better term, is coming of age politically, it has in several states, but now as a national community, it is sort of a blunt force weapon to try to put into question the participation and the influence and the contributions in this community in a way that affects a number of things, either investments in education or in healthcare or in community empowerment, electoral participation, a number of other things. So some of these folks are very good at using symbolic language or coded language to evoke and press these buttons of fear or anxiety. And they seem to be fairly apparent, particularly when we're in the midst of an electoral season, right? So what's been happening now? In addition to the voter restriction laws that have spread like wildfire around the country, we have also seen now at least 13 states who are asking the Department of Homeland Security that they want access to their database so they can purge non-citizens from their voting rolls, even though probably 99.9% of them have not been able to produce any sort of evidence that that kind of thing is a problem. Again, fact-free zone, right? It's all about creating the perception, and the perception becomes true. And so at the end of the day, I agree that SB 1070 at its core, if you connect it back to this, is a lot less about immigration, and it's more like the stop and frisk laws that we've been seeing and hearing about in New York, which have an indiscriminate impact on African-American and Latino communities being stopped by police in numbers that are completely unrelated to the level of criminal activity by those communities. So it really is about, you know, the erosion of due process and police powers. And by the way, I think that there's been an incredible amount now of voices from the law enforcement community speaking up against their role as enforcers in immigration. And, you know, that needs to be recognized. At the same time, as a management issue, imagine if you are a police chief with a rogue element in your force, and now there's this oldest gray area for that element to operate in. It also poses a management challenge for police enforcement, for law enforcement, just as a side note. So in terms of where we are right now, yes, the Obama administration announced the relief for Dreamers, which is really a temporary stay of deportation, right? I think what's important to note about that is that you know, in the political discourse, it became something about, oh, Obama just did this to try to get Latino votes, and you know, and then when Romney tried to backtrack from his lack of answer on it, he got attacked for doing the same. What I would say is that, and you probably saw it in the last presidential debate this week, that both candidates, I think, would like to avoid talking about this issue. And the Obama administration really, in many ways, got pressured and forced to implement Relief for Dreamers as a result of incredible organizing by Dreamers themselves and immigrant communities and immigrant rights advocates, but also in response to the growing influence of the Latino electorate. And in a way, that's part of the reason why Romney didn't just come out and say he opposed Dream Relief downright either, even though they haven't gone very far and tried to really work to attract the Latino community, but that was part of it. And so one of the things we're really committed to is figuring out how do we increase the ability and the opportunity for Latino community and allies to get more engaged in these issue and policy debates. Electoral participation for us is a step on that path, but it's not the end all, which is a lot of the times how elections get dealt with, right? It's a one-time thing, and then we all move on. So the idea is that, at least for us at NCLR, making the ability and the opportunity for Latinos to register and participate means that then parties have to fight for the vote of those potential voters, and they have to come and convince them that they're the best option. And then after the election, hold those candidates accountable to actually advance solutions on immigration and on other issues. What we hope to see is that we have a party that doesn't neglect Latino voters and that actually does more to advance real solutions as opposed to just maligning the community, but also have another party that doesn't take these voters for granted or stands on the sidelines while this community is taking a pummeling, right, or stays silent. And there have been notable exceptions on both. Anyway, so I'll leave it at that. The only remaining note I'll tell you about, just because this is happening right now, is we've been working on voter registration in a number of states. This is something we've done in several cycles. And our flagship state is Florida. We have our most experienced team there. And by the time we wrap up our voter registration operations today, we should be at around 50,000 voter registrations in the state of Florida. And the Florida Department of State has decided to come after us and raise allegations about our work. And the first of those allegations seems to have come up rather bogus. So now they, you know, this is the way things happen in a lot of circles, right? So on Friday night, yesterday, after hours, when the offices of the Department of State in Florida and everybody else are closed, their communications director sent an email to our reporter about these allegations to try to feed and create a story that would fester over the weekend when we are unable to go to the offices of any of these agencies to demand an explanation. Anyway, we are proud of our work. We have very experienced and committed teams on the ground who are registering real people who are eligible to vote. And we're going to see this through, but it's no coincidence that they decided to start putting these things out there in the midst of a story that exploded of investigating a firm hired by the Republican Party of Florida who was found to have processed hundreds of fraudulent voter registrations in the state. So it's a dirty game. And as we know in the immigration front, it costs lives. And that's why I think our community has shown, and immigrants show this every day, that they're resilient. And the least we feel we can do is work in the trenches to create more opportunities for those voices to be elevated. America represents an ideal. The United States of America is a country, but more than anything, it really is an ideal that beckons people in other parts. And then you may get here and have a rude awakening, but nevertheless, it is an ideal, and I think that as a country, whether we are native, naturalized citizens, or you know, or immigrants in one stage of that process or another, we all see it as an aspiring ideal, right? And the reason I want to say that is because I would really like us to own that. I've been in a lot of conversations with where people, you know, feel that they need to reject the United States, you know, the notion of it as a country or the idea of America. And I think we ought to own it. We ought to own it and remind people of what it has always been. And the fact that every immigrant wave in the past, yes, they integrated, but they also were brutally rejected every time. My hope is that we can get through this latest chapter in a more accelerated fashion and without having to take all the, you know, all the hits that we've taken in the past. And frankly, that the current wave of immigrants as we integrate, we do not do unto others as it was done unto us, right? And that we don't find ourselves 20, 30 years from now saying, well, my ancestors didn't come like that. They came the right way, whatever the right or the wrong way might be 20 or 30 years from now. But it is that constant thing. And I do want to throw it out there because, again, I think a lot of times our frustration with the state of things can translate into a rejection of the notion of this country and what it stands for. And it doesn't mean that we're perfect. It means that we have work to do. And we ought to take it back for those who are seeking to take those values and ideas and either minimize them or try to redefine them into something they're not.